Well, okay, it's, what time is it again? I have to check my other monitor. 15:16, 15:17, December 20th, 2022, 15:17 hours. Ward Green is my name, and I wanted to share with you that I installed the first piece of the first piece of canvas. That first canvas, the one I opened, the package that I opened of the three canvas packages I received, I put that outside. I've installed it now, using some stiff stranded electrical wire that I just happen to have. For many years I've had this wire and I've used it sometimes to tie things, but because I didn't have the right length of, there's no, well, I have rope, but I didn't have any proper, like, if I were going to do it with a piece of, I could use a chain, perhaps. Could I? No, because no, I couldn't. There's no, I need a carabiner. I mean, if I was going to use a carabiner, let's say, it would have to be big enough to span the whole distance from the grommet to the edge of the canvas, which is about, 3 inches or something, two or 3 inches. There's no way that any carabiner is big enough unless it's a very expensive carabiner, so I wasn't going to use a carabiner. So I had to tie, so I could use a carabiner, but I have to tie something into the grommet first, around the canvas and into the grommet, and span that 2 inches. So I could have used wire and then a carabiner, but the carabiner didn't fit through the eye hook that was already installed, because those eye hooks already have canvas strung with carabiners, so there's no room in the eye hook to pass another carabiner. Even though it was a very small carabiner, there's just no room, so I couldn't do that. But I just used wire. I tied them with wire, and I think that's going to be, I think it will last many years, because even if the insulation on the wire disintegrates, the metallic part, whether it's aluminum or whatever type of metal it is on the inside of that wire, I don't believe it's copper wire, but it's going to, it that metallic stranded part of the wire is going to last for many years. It can withstand the sun, so that's going to last as far as the attachment goes, I believe, as long as it doesn't pull free. It's tied with a double knot. It's I in the wire is, so it's I don't think that type of a connection is likely to come undone easily at all. So anyway, I think it's going to be good. And the interesting thing was that the canvas was exactly the right width. That I couldn't believe. That it was the same width as the existing distance between the eye hooks. But what I was doing was I spanned across the gap in the two first canvases that are there. There's a gap between the first two, and then the second and third overlapped because there was 14 feet to span using 18 feet of canvas. So 6 feet each canvas, 18 feet, three canvases, and 14-foot wide deck. I had to overlap two of the canvases. So where the canvas was not overlapped, that's where I tore the canvas. I tore the grommet part of the canvas. So I wanted to cover that with a new piece of canvas across, so across the point where the two existing canvases meet. I'm now spanning that with the new canvas. So the new canvas, it goes across, it spans across that central connection, so it's covered now, and it's got a very wide overlap on both sides. It's got 2.5 feet, or it's 5 feet, it's 6 feet roughly. The canvas is about 6 feet wide, so it's 3 feet span on either side of this gap in the two canvases. It's going to prevent a lot of snow from getting in that would have gotten in before. It's going to prevent the wind from blowing directly on that tear in the canvas. So it's going to prevent, it's going to really assist things until the spring comes and I can help repair that existing tear, the canvas that was existing that got torn. I'll glue a piece of goop, I mean a piece of leather with goop. I'll glue a piece of leather, across that tear, and maybe I'll even glue the two pieces of canvas together with the leather, a scrap of leather that I just bought recently. I bought the scraps, 1 kilogram of scrap leather. I'll just glue a piece of scrap leather on the back of the canvases. So I'll glue the two canvases either together or glue to repair that grommet. One or the other, or both. I'll fix that in the spring, I think, when it's warm enough so the glue can dry. Otherwise, I'd have to put a hairdryer out in the snow and hang it out there, and that could catch fire or something. I don't really want to do that, but I'd have to do that to dry the glue, unless I can think of another way to do it. I can't dry the glue in the wintertime, so I've just got a clamp on there now, a spring clamp, and I can leave the spring clamp out there maybe till spring. Or I could just covering it with this new piece of canvas means I can take that spring clamp off too. I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet, but I needed to cover that gap, I realized. It should have been covered all along. I just didn't have the money to buy more canvas. I think that was the reason. So now I've put that one piece of canvas out there. I've got two more pieces of canvas I can use for the door and the back wall of the carport that will keep the snow out. Should be very effective, I think, as a way to keep the snow out. I don't think much snow is going to get in this year once I get that other canvas hung. So I'll have to fold it in various ways, or attach it in the right way, I should say. I won't have to fold it maybe, but the door piece will be folded because it's too wide. It'll be folded once, and that will make it 3 feet wide, and that'll be perfect to cover the door. And then the other one will fold. They're 7 feet long, though, so the 7 feet long part, which is something like 80 some inches, you know. I think they're supposed to be 8 feet, but I think they're just a little over 7 feet long. But let me think now. It hung to the ground, and I measured the height was about 6. It hung to the ground and a bit more. So it's lying on the ground, which is always bad. But in the spring, too, I can glue it up. I can glue it so that it doesn't touch the ground. I can use goop to do that. It's just a question of I didn't have the goop to do it before. I didn't have enough goop. I'm trying to think whether I want to do that or not, but if it drags on the ground, it will wear out and get tattered. That's the problem. So I could glue it. I just fold up the bottom. That's what I could do. The grommets at the bottom corners. Could I just cut the canvas off? No, I don't think so. I wouldn't do that. I'd want it to be stronger at the bottom. I'd fold it. I'd double it back on itself at the bottom if I were going to do anything. But it doesn't have to be done. I mean, it'll last through the winter without getting torn because it'll just be sitting on the snow. So it's when it drags on the gravel, that's when it gets torn. So anyway, there's lots to still think of and design here, but I'm not going to be building a structure on a carport. It just doesn't make sense unless it makes sense, which it doesn't, right? But for one thing, I don't have the authority to do that without a building permit. But to hang canvas, I can do that without a building permit. So, because it's going to swing in the wind. It's not going to create stress on the structure or anything. And I don't have to worry about frost heaving, which I would have to worry about and be careful about otherwise. I'm not averse to building something. It's just, here's the problem. Whenever I design something, and I go and show it, I used to talk to the building inspector, the building inspector of many years before he retired. His name was Raleigh, was his nickname. And he was a really nice guy, and I used to go to talk to him, and I'd talk about what I wanted to do. And at one point, he just left it up to me and said, I'll leave it up to you to do what you think is right, because he trusted me at that point that I would do everything correctly. And that was when I was building my second deck that the one that didn't come with the house. It was 14 by 20 feet, and it was a pretty big project. But at some point, he just said he didn't even come to inspect it or anything. He just trusted that I was doing it right, so didn't need to inspect what I was doing, nothing, because I talked to him enough and explained all of what I was concerned about, to the point where he knew that I cared about it as much as he did, or even more maybe. So he didn't need to inspect my work, but that was a great thing. But of course, he retired. But the thing is, even when I talked to him about what I wanted to do, like I had ideas, I wanted to do things, he'd say, yeah, you could do that. And like if it was, some of it was internal construction, I wanted to put in, I wanted to lay in battens along my joists, just like 1 inch below the flooring or something. And then I wanted to lay in, or whatever, 3/4 inch below the flooring, I wanted to lay in these battens, like rails. And then on top of those rails, I wanted to put plywood. So I wanted to double the thickness. I wanted to double the thickness of my floor from below by inserting, you know, 14 and a half wide strips of plywood in between the 16 inch on center joists. I wanted to do strips. I mean, that was one of my plans. I wanted to do that. And he said, that's fine. But of course, we don't need a building permit to do stuff on the inside of our house. Maybe back then, I think we did. But he didn't see any problem with me doing that anyway. But of course, the thing is, it was great to know I could do it, but I never got around to doing it, because I might still do it, maybe, because I'm allowed to do it. It's an internal construction project inside the house, interior, I mean. So it's fully legal to do that. But wouldn't that be a lot of work? But it would prevent maybe creaking in the floor and stuff like that. You know, I mean, but the problem would be, well, then, you see, I could screw the flooring up into the existing flooring. That would help prevent it from flexing and squeaking. But and I could also put the rails in underneath and make sure they're up tight against somehow, right? By wedging or whatever. I mean, I could put these pieces in and then wedge them in, put the rails in, and then wedge the rails up onto the new piece I put in, and that piece would then be pushed up against the existing piece. The problem is that the existing piece might not be screwed all the way down, so it might just get pushed up even higher than it should be. That's not really the way to do it. You need to fix it from above and screw down through the existing joists, and you can't do that when you have finished floor. So it's difficult to do that with finished flooring in place. You're going to see what you do from above. You're going to see any nails or screws that you put down through, so you can't really screw down through your finished flooring. It's a problem, because eventually the floor gets creaky. But that's a problem I'm going to solve maybe later, but I have every confidence that I can solve anything with Jehovah's help. I mean, anything can be done. And Jehovah does support us when we really have faith that we try to do things His way, and we, you know, that's what having faith is, being humble enough to observe His word, the Bible, and understand what He demands of us, which is not really very much, but it's devotion to Him is what He demands, which means giving up the things we love, like addictions and things like that. Coffee being a big one that people need to give up if they want to be with Jehovah, if they want to be closer. If they want to get close at all to Jehovah, they have to give up their addictions. So you're not going to be even close otherwise. It's just so sad. But anyway, I mean, it's sad to me that people don't know these things, and they're not taught these things. That's what's sad. It's not sad that, I mean, I don't spend a lot of time feeling sad about all the people who are addicted to things, because, I mean, there's no advantage in that. I try to spend my time constructively helping people in whatever way I can, not feeling sad about them, because that's more constructive and useful, right? And it doesn't incapacitate me like it would if I were feeling sad all the time. So now I want to change the subject a little bit, though. This has been a wonderful chat about getting the new canvas. So yeah, okay, I was talking about the interior work, I can do that. Any kind of interior work that I want to do, I can do. I've got this ash that I'm processing, so I might use it for interior work or whatever. But exterior work, you know, you're allowed to replace certain things on your exterior of your house. Yes, you can do that. So that can be done. But you're not allowed to build new structure on the outside without a permit, and that's for good reason. And I mentioned that before, that, for example, a wind blowing on your house might affect your house differently if you build some structure and add something new to your house. That can be affected by how the wind blows against your house, or, you know, it just affects things, or it could weaken the structure because of the way that you attach it. It's possible that it makes it look bad, and so it makes the neighborhood worse. And because it's permanent, it's not like just hanging canvas, which can be rectified, you know, very easily if it doesn't look good. By the way, this new canvas is a different color than what I had before, but the old one looks completely old and tattered. The old one is, at the bottom, it's tattered, and it's lost a lot of color. It used to be dark brown, and now it's very light in color. It's totally sun-bleached canvas. The old canvas is sun-bleached, and the new one's going to be soon probably the same color, or very, even though it's dark green compared to dark brown. They're not going to differ too much by the time they get sun-bleached, I guess. The new one, when the sun bleaches the new one, I'm not sure what the difference will be. But right now, it looks like it's a different color entirely. I really don't think that that's going to look bad, because it's functional. And something that's functional doesn't look bad. It looks good when it's functional. That's the you know, form follows function. Frank Lloyd Wright, the principle that he used. And that's one of the reasons, or one of the things he did based on that principle, was he would build all his houses using full sheets of plywood. He never cut a piece of plywood except when he had to put a door in the house or so. But he would build, even if he had to put a door in a house, he would try to build a house where the plywood came up to the edge of the door, and on the other side was a new complete piece of plywood or something, or whatever, you know. I don't know how you could do that. But if it was possible to do it, he would do it that way. He would rather do that than cut a piece of plywood. He never wanted to waste any piece, and he never wanted to have a leftover scrap, nothing. He didn't want to cut anything. He didn't want to create dust, probably, from the cuttings. He just didn't want to use any unnecessary procedures to build a house. So he used complete full sheets and full lengths of timbers, and he tried to keep everything full length. And his houses had wonderful, wonderful, elegance to them because of the way they were designed. And they were beautiful. But form always followed function for him. So anyway, now I'd like to talk about Lauren Lachman. And I've got a video here for us to watch. Little children, let's see what he's got to say, because he's an expert on fasting. And just listen to the experience he had. Hopefully it'll be it'll be a good enough quality of audio. It's a little bit low in volume, but because there's background noise in this video, so hopefully it's adequate. But he's talking about what happened to him when he injured himself, and how fasting helped him while he was injured. So perhaps you want to listen to this. It's extremely interesting to me what he learned here, and what he taught or tried to teach others, and what he's been teaching people also about fasting because of what he knows.
Hi, it's Lauren Lachman, and today I'm coming to you from the Tanglewood Wellness Center in Costa Rica, and I'm going to be sharing one of my own personal healing stories with you. Over the last 20 years that I've been involved with fasting and a raw food diet, I've had some pretty amazing things happen to me. And the first really amazing thing happened, it's been probably 14 years ago now, roughly. I was completing some renovation work. I was doing the work myself on a house that I was living in. And I had a enclosed stairwell to the basement, which was all concrete, cement, and concrete stairs to the basement. And I decided to go ahead and finish that space. And I was standing on a kitchen stool, not unlike the one I'm on now, swiveled. And I had scraps and tools on the floor, and so it wasn't exactly stable. And this isn't sounding too smart right now, I recognize, but I'm standing on this swivelly, uneven stool. And I'm doing some plaster work up near the ceiling. And I leaned out too far, and I kicked the stool down the stairs. And I went tumbling down afterwards. And when I landed on the basement floor, and again, this was a cement floor, there was a stack of drywall corner bead. Now, if you're not familiar with this stuff, anytime you have an inside corner, a corner that projects into a room, and it's wallboard, there's a piece of metal molding, which is about, it's 8 feet long, and it's about an inch on either face, and it's at a 90-degree angle, and you screw that to the corner, and you plaster over it, and that's how you get that nice, sharp corner. Well, there was a stack of this material lying on the floor with one edge standing up, and when I landed on the basement floor, my left wrist came down right on top of this stack of material and bounced and came down again. And if you take a look, I'm going to come a little closer so you can see. If you look at my wrist, you can probably see the scars here and here. Take that watch out of the way. There and up here. And those were the scars that were caused by that accident. As it happened, I had severed all of the flexor tendons in my hand. And it's the flexor tendons that allow you to flex your fingers. The extensor tendons are here. These are the flexor tendons here. I'd severed all the tendons to my fingers twice. Once here and once here. Here and here. I had also severed one of the two arteries to my hand in two places as it runs through the wrist. And I'd severed all the nerves to the side of my hand. And I called myself an ambulance, I went to the hospital, and I wound up getting hand surgery that day, later that evening, with a hand surgeon who spent 5 hours reconnecting all of that tissue. And I woke up the next morning, they put me out, and I woke up, and I had surgical thread sewn through, right through the ends of each of my fingers. Now, he hadn't told me this was going to happen, so I was pretty freaked out to wake up and see these threads literally going right through the pad of my finger and out through the fingernail. It didn't hurt. I didn't feel it. About 2 days later, I saw for the first time a man whose business was called Hand Rehab Services. And Sam fashioned a hood for me out of plastic that was molded to my hand. And my hand was strapped to it here. No, I had no movement. My hand was like this. But my hand was strapped to it here, across the palm, and it was strapped down here. And these threads were attached to rubber bands, which were attached to the piece on my arm. And the idea was that as I started to get movement back, it was okay for me to flex my fingers, extend my fingers, but they didn't want me to flex them. So I would extend them, and the rubber bands would pull them back down. And that was the idea. Well, 2 days after the surgery, I went to see the hand surgeon in his office, and he told me that the surgery went well, but there was no guarantee I would ever have full use of my hand again because there had been a lot of damage, and he'd done the best he could, but he couldn't offer any guarantees. And when the next day I went to see Sam, the hand rehab guy, who and both these guys only focused on hands and wrists, Sam told me the same thing. In fact, the surgeon, too, and Sam both said I would be in physical therapy for at least a year, and there were no guarantees that that was how severe the damage was. So I began to see Sam, and the first week I saw him every day, and it was kind of like magic. He would rub creams on my wrist and massage it. He would have me put my hand in this machine that blew hot sawdust all around it, and there was magnets, and it all seemed to me a little bit crazy. I wasn't really sure what the point of some of these things were, but I trusted that he knew what he was doing, and I let him do his work. And first week I saw him every day, and the second week I believe it was every other day, and then it began to be two or three times a week. And finally, within about 3 or 4 weeks, The surgical threads came out of my fingers. I now had movement back. I was able to use my hand. And it was 7 weeks, almost to the day, after the accident. I went to see Sam, and he did all the stuff he usually did. And then he wanted to do diagnostic, and he had started doing this periodically. So he would have me, first of all, put my hand on the table between us and lean over it to see how much flexion there was in this wrist. There was no flexion at all. When the accident happened, I couldn't move it. And he wanted to see how it was now. Well, I showed him what I could do, and he was really surprised. He said, "Let me see the other one." So I showed him how flexible that wrist was. And he was, again, he was very surprised. I said, "Let me see yours." And this man, who had not had a wrist or hand injury, had less flexion in either of his hands than I had in the one that had just been injured less than 7 weeks earlier. Then he tested my the flexibility of my fingers, the strength of my hand, and the strength of my fingers versus my right hand, and I'm right-handed. And he was amazed by what he saw. In fact, he took all these measurements down, and he looked at his clipboard, and he said, "I don't know how to explain this." I said, "What, Sam?" He said, "Well, I've been doing this for 27 years. I've never seen anything like this before." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, you're completely healed. You don't need to come back." Now, if you remember from just a few minutes ago, I told you that both the hand surgeon and the hand rehab guy told me I would be in physical therapy for at least a year and that it was no guarantee. And yet, 7 weeks later, almost to the day, he tells me it's completely healed and he doesn't need to ever see me again. And I said, "Oh, I can explain that." And he said, "Oh, really?" So now you may be able to guess, if you've been watching my videos, you may understand that Tanglewood is a fasting center. The fasting is the way, the most efficient and effective way for us to get out of the way so the body can cleanse and heal itself. So when this accident happened, what do you think I did? Well, I didn't have another meal from the time the accident happened for a couple weeks. And I could have gone longer, except that, frankly, I was self-employed and not really in a position to not be doing anything. And I wanted to rest completely while I was fasting. So I rested completely for 2 weeks. I did wind up driving myself to see Sam after the first meeting, which was a little challenging with the stick shift, but I made that work. And other than going to see him, I spent my entire time resting completely and doing absolutely nothing. And then I explained to him that in addition to that, both for 6 or 7 years prior to the accident and ever since I had ended my fast, I've been living on simple mono meals of fruit and simple leafy green salads. And the whole thing was brand new information to him, but to give him credit, he was open to it. In fact, Sam ran his business from 5 a.m. until 8 p.m. because he was busiest before and after work. Most people wanted to see him when they didn't have to be at work during their office hours. So that was actually his busiest time, but he was open all day long as well. And he worked these very long days, and he spent his whole day snacking on garbage, donuts, candy, etc. Now, at that point, I was in my 30s. Sam was probably 50 or 55, and he was starting to feel his age. And so he hired me to help him make some changes. And then we wound up losing touch with each other after several months, and he actually wound up moving out of the area. I think he may have retired. So I'm not really sure what happened. But, you know, it was interesting. When I left Sam's office that day, I thought to myself, this hand surgeon, the guy that did the surgery on me, he's going to want to know what happened so he can help as many other clients heal as quickly as possible. And so as soon as I got home, I called the surgeon, and I got him on the phone, and I said, "Doc, I don't know if you remember me 7 weeks earlier." He said, "Oh, yeah, sure, Lauren, how you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm doing great. I just wanted to let you know. But I just came from Sam's office, and Sam told me I'm completely healed and he doesn't need to see me again." And he said, "Great, thanks," and he hung up. I can only surmise he wasn't that interested in what had happened. He had already gotten paid. He didn't care. He'd already earned his money, and that was the end of that as far as he was concerned. But you know, the moral of the story is that When we give the body a chance to heal itself, amazing things happen virtually every single time. There's little that the body is not capable of healing. There are some things that may never heal, but the very best we can do is to get out of the way as completely as possible and give the body that opportunity to cleanse and heal itself. When we do that, we're going to see amazing shifts each time. So thanks for sharing this with me. I hope this has been interesting for you, and I'll see you again. Bye-bye.
So that was extremely informative from Loren Lockman. He fasted for, I believe he said, a couple of weeks. He was fasting. But when he wasn't fasting, he would eat these mono meals. That's the other thing he did. He ate one type of food only. One type of fruit or one type of vegetable, whatever he was eating, was all that he ate for that meal. Every time he ate a meal. That was the way he'd been eating prior to this accident, and he was aware of fasting as well. He'd known about fasting, and he did a 14-day fast, it sounded like, from what he said there. I'm not certain if I've got that correct, but he did quite a lengthy fast there. I believe it was 14 days, and that helped him to heal from the injury. It shows the power of fasting, because he healed in 7 weeks what normally would take a year, according to his doctor. So anyway, let's get to our study now, perhaps little children. Today we're going to be studying a lot, I think. We'll do Psalm 80, Isaiah 60, and Matthew, catching up, 8 through 10. To the director upon the lilies, a reminder of Asaph, a melody. O shepherd of Israel, do give ear, you who are conducting Joseph just like a flock. O you who are sitting upon the cherubs, do beam forth before Ephraim and Benjamin and Manasseh. Do rouse up your mightiness and do come to our salvation. O God, bring us back and light up your face that we may be saved. O Jehovah, God of armies, how long must you fume against the prayer of your people? You have made them eat the bread of tears, and you keep making them drink tears upon tears in great measure. You set us for strife to our neighbors, and our very enemies keep deriding as they please. O God of armies, bring us back and light up your face that we may be saved. You proceeded to make a vine depart from Egypt, and you kept driving out the nations that you might plant it. You made a clearing before it, that it might take root and fill the land. The mountains were covered with its shadow, and the cedars of God with its boughs. It gradually sent forth its boughs as far as the sea, and to the river its twigs. That being, once again, the Euphrates River. Why have you broken down its stone walls? And why have all those passing by on the road plucked at it? A boar out of the woods keeps eating it away, and the animal throngs of the open field keep feeding upon it. O God of armies, return, please. Look down from heaven and see and take care of this vine and the stalk that your right hand has planted. And look upon the son whom you have made strong for yourself. It is burned with fire, cut off. From the rebuke of your face they perish. Let your hand prove to be upon the man of your right hand, upon the son of mankind, whom you have made strong for yourself, and we shall not turn back from you. May you preserve us alive, that we may call upon your own name. O Jehovah, God of armies, bring us back, light up your face, that we may be saved. That's Psalm 80. The theme there is, bring us back, light up your face, that we may be saved. Psalm 80. Let your hand prove to be upon the man of your right hand. Verse 17. Why couldn't I say that the first time? I'm not sure. But it's a beautiful psalm here. It talks about these beautiful illustrations of a vine departing from Egypt, and Jehovah driving out nations so that he could plant this vine. The vine creating, having a growth that created a significant sized plant that covered the mountains with its shadow. That's quite an illustration. And the cedars of God, it covered with its boughs. We know cedars can get quite large in that part of the world, in Lebanon, for example. So to cover the cedars with the boughs of the vine meant Israel was a very powerful nation. It was a symbolic idea, this vine being so large that it would cover the cedars and the mountains with its boughs and its shadow, respectively. It gradually sent forth its boughs as far as the sea and to the Euphrates River. Its twigs were stretching. Why have you broken down its stone walls? So something bad happened at some point, and to this vine Israel, but we know that, of course, Israel was destroyed. Jerusalem was destroyed, but Israel was taken into exile. In the northern part of the kingdom, was taken into exile by Sargon of Assyria, and Judah was taken into exile by Babylon's Nebuchadnezzar in 597 and 587 BCE. But we also know that, of course, Israel was delivered in 539. We know that. At least, this, you know, the part that was taken by Babylon was delivered, that is, in 539 by Cyrus when he conquered Babylon. But in the beginning of this psalm, it's written by, it says again, by Asaph here, of Asaph. So, yeah, right. And, this is a wonderful illustration. This is a wonderful figurative idea here of eating the bread of tears. That's what an illustration is. It's a figurative thing. And you keep making them drink tears upon tears in great measure. You have made them eat the bread of tears. What a wonderful illustration. I can't say the word illustration for some reason. What a wonderful illustration. What a wonderful illustration. Wonderful ill is hard. Full ill is hard. Wonderful illustration is hard to say because of the two L's. What a magnificent illustration would be easier to say. What a beautiful, beautiful is hard too because it ends in ill. What a lovely illustration it is. Eating the bread of tears. What a poignant illustration that is. It's so beautiful. I just, only in the Bible do we see these beautiful linguistic, poetic expressions. I just love it. That's why I love the Bible so much. But also, it's this translation too that's so minimalist in the way it's so perfect in the way it presents the translation. You know, the more or less literal translation, but it preserves so much of the poetry. It captures the poetry so beautifully. And that was Psalm 80. We're looking at Isaiah 60 now. Arise, O woman, shed forth light, for your light has come, and upon you the very glory of Jehovah has shone forth. For look, darkness itself will cover the earth, and thick gloom the national groups, but upon you Jehovah will shine forth, and upon you his own glory will be seen. And nations will certainly go to your light, and kings to the brightness of your shining forth. Now usually, woman is referring to Jerusalem or something like that. Raise your eyes all around and see. They have all of them been collected together. That's talking about the nations. They've come to you from far away. Your own sons keep coming. And your daughters, who will be taken care of on the flank. At that time you will see and certainly become radiant, and your heart will actually quiver and expand, because to you the wealthiness of the sea will direct itself. The very resources of the nations will come to you. The heaving mass of camels itself will cover you, the young male camels of Midian and Ephah. All those from Sheba, they will come. Gold and frankincense they will carry. And the praises of Jehovah they will announce. All the flocks of Kedar, they will be collected together to you. The rams of Nebaioth, they will minister to you. With approval, they will come up upon my altar, and I shall beautify my own house of beauty. Who are these that come flying just like a cloud and like doves to their birdhouse holes? For in me the islands themselves will keep hoping, the ships of Tarshish also as at the first, in order to bring your sons from far away, their silver and their gold being with them, to the name of Jehovah your God, and to the Holy One of Israel, for he will have beautified you. And foreigners will actually build your walls, and their own kings will minister to you. For in my indignation I shall have struck you, but in my goodwill I shall certainly have mercy upon you. And your gates will actually be kept open constantly. They will not be closed even by day or by night, in order to bring to you the resources of the nations, and their kings will be taking the lead. For any nation and any kingdom that will not serve you will perish, and the nations themselves will without fail come to devastation. To you the very glory of Lebanon will come, the juniper tree, the ash tree, and the cypress at the same time, in order to beautify the place of my sanctuary, and I shall glorify the very place of my feet. And to you the sons of those afflicting you must go, bowing down, and all those treating you disrespectfully must bend down at the very soles of your feet. And they will have to call you the city of Jehovah, Zion, of the Holy One of Israel. That's the woman, right? Instead of your proving to be one left entirely and hated, with nobody passing through, I will even set you as a thing of pride to time indefinite, an exaltation for generation after generation. And you will actually suck the milk of nations, and the breast of kings you will suck. And you will be certain to know that I, Jehovah, am your Savior, and the powerful one of Jacob is your repurchaser. Instead of the copper, I shall bring in gold, and instead of the iron, I shall bring in silver. And instead of the wood, copper. And instead of the stones, iron. And I will appoint peace as your overseers, and righteousness as your task assigners. No more will violence be heard in your land, despoiling or breakdown within your boundaries. And you will certainly call your own walls salvation, and your gates praise. For you the sun will no more prove to be a light by day, and for brightness the moon itself will no more give you light. And Jehovah must become to you an indefinitely lasting light, and your God your beauty. No more will your sun set, nor will your moon go on the wane, for Jehovah himself will become for you an indefinitely lasting light, and the days of your mourning will have come to completion. And as for your people, all of them will be righteous. To time indefinite they will hold possession of the land, the sprout of my planting, the work of my hands, for me to be beautified. The little one himself will become a thousand, and the small one a mighty nation. I myself, Jehovah, shall speed it up in its own time. Isaiah chapter 60, that's the end of that. So the woman, but it was talking about Jerusalem, Mount Zion, Jerusalem, the woman. Darkness will cover the earth, but it won't cover Jerusalem. Verses 1 and 2. But nations will go to your light, verse 3. And then they have all of them been collected together. They have come to you. The nations are coming to you. Your own sons keep coming. So why are they why were they Jerusalem's own sons if they came from the nations? Well, they were adopted into Jerusalem from these other places. the daughters who would be taken care of on the flank, in other words, carried on the hip, by taken care of by the mother. You know, the way a child is carried on the flank, or on the hip, or by the father, but a daughter, a very young infant daughter, could be carried in that way, and also the sons, of course. But these children would be coming and helping Israel, helping Jerusalem. That's what was prophesied here. In verse 5, the very resources of nations were going to come to Jerusalem. But it keeps calling them their own sons, because if you look down, to bring your sons from far away, verse 9, the ships of Tarshish were going to bring the sons of Jerusalem from far away. And in verse 7, Jehovah was promising he would beautify his own house of beauty. An interesting illustration there. Or actually not really an illustration, an interesting choice of words, I should say. It's not an illustration at all. But in his goodwill, he was going to have mercy in verse 10. But foreigners would build their walls. Kings would minister to them in verse 10. So these children that were coming from far away were the same people as these people who were the foreigners and the kings that were going to minister to Israel at Jerusalem. The gates would be kept open. That's Jerusalem's gates, but symbolic of Israel's gates. That's an illustration too, that one. I mean, that one is actually an illustration. For any nation that will not serve you will perish. So it's pretty strong words, pretty encouraging for Israel in Isaiah chapter 60. And at the end, of course, the little one himself will become a thousand, and the small one a mighty nation. I myself, Jehovah, shall speed it up in its own time. The little one himself will become a thousand, and the small one a mighty nation. Matthew 8, talking about Jesus. After he had come down from the mountain, great crowds followed him, after he had given his sermon on the mount. And look, a leprous man came up and began doing obeisance to him, saying, Lord, if you just want to, you can make me clean. And so stretching out his hand, he touched him, saying, I want to be made clean. And immediately his leprosy was cleansed away. Then Jesus said to him, see that you tell no one, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift that Moses appointed for the purpose of a witness to them. When he entered into Capernaum, an army officer, came to him, entreating him and saying, sir, my manservant is laid up in the house with paralysis, being terribly tormented. He said to him, when I get there, I will cure him. In reply, the army officer said, sir, I am not a fit man for you to enter under my roof, but just say the word and my manservant will be healed. For I too am a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me, and I say to this one, be on your way, and he is on his way, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my slave, do this, and he does it. Hearing that, Jesus became amazed and said to those following him, I tell you the truth, with no one in Israel have I found so great a faith, but I tell you that many from eastern parts and western parts will come and recline at the table with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of the heavens, whereas the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the darkness outside. There is where their weeping and the gnashing of their teeth will be. Then Jesus said to the army officer, go, just as it has been your faith, so let it come to pass for you. And the man's servant was healed in that hour. And Jesus, on coming into Peter's house, saw his mother-in-law lying down and sick with fever. So he touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she got up and began ministering to him. But after it became evening, people brought him many demon-possessed persons, and he expelled the spirits with a word, and he cured all who were faring badly, that there might be fulfilled what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet, saying, "He himself took our sicknesses and carried our diseases." One moment, please. Okay. And in Isaiah, it's in Isaiah 53 and 4, we see the reference up here. Truly our sicknesses, talking about the Messiah, were what he himself carried. The Messiah was going to carry their sickness. And as for our pains, he bore them. When Isaiah saw a crowd, not Isaiah, when Jesus, Jehoshua is the Hebrew name for Jesus, when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave the command to shove off for the other side. And a certain scribe came up and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you are about to go." But Jesus said to him, "Foxes have dens, and birds of heaven have roosts, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay down his head." Then another of the disciples said to him, "Lord, permit me first to leave and bury my father." Jesus said to him, "Keep following me and let the dead bury their dead." So when he got aboard a boat, his disciples followed him. And look, a great agitation arose in the sea so that the boat was being covered by the waves. He, however, was sleeping. And they came and woke him up, saying, "Lord, save us. We are about to perish." But he said to them, "Why are you faint-hearted, you with little faith?" Then, getting up, he rebuked the winds and the sea, and a great calm set in. So the men became amazed and said, "What sort of person is this that even the winds and the sea obey him?" When he got to the other side, into the country of the Gadarenes, there he met two demon-possessed men coming out from among the memorial tombs, unusually fierce, so that nobody had the courage to pass by on that road. And look, they screamed, saying, "What have we to do with you, Son of God? Did you come here to torment us before the appointed time?" But a long way off from them, a herd of many swine was at pasture. So the demons began to entreat him, saying, "If you expel us, send us forth into the herd of swine." Accordingly, he said to them, "Go." They came out and went off into the swine. And look, the entire herd rushed over the precipice into the sea and died in the waters. But the herders fled, and going into the city, they reported everything, including the affair of the demon-possessed man. And look, all the city turned out to meet Jesus, and after having seen him, they earnestly urged him to move out from their districts. That was Matthew chapter 8. Matthew 9. So boarding the boat, he proceeded across and went into his own city. And look, they were bringing him a paralyzed man lying on a bed. On seeing their faith, Jesus said to the paralytic, "Take courage, child, your sins are forgiven." And look, certain of the scribes said to themselves, "This fellow is blaspheming." And Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said, "Why are you thinking wicked things in your hearts? For instance, which is easier to say, 'Your sins are forgiven,' or to say, 'Get up and walk'? However, in order for you to know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, then he said to the paralytic, get up, pick up your bed and go to your home. And he got up and went off to his home. At the sight of this, the crowds were struck with fear, and they glorified God who gave such authority to men. Next, while passing along from there, Jesus caught sight of a man named Matthew seated at the tax office, and he said to him, be my follower. Thereupon he did rise up and follow him. Later, while he was reclining at the table in the house, look, many tax collectors and sinners came and began reclining with Jesus and his disciples. But on seeing this, the Pharisees began to say to his disciples, why is it that your teacher eats with tax collectors and sinners? Hearing them, he said, persons in health do not need a physician, but the ailing do. Go then and learn what this means. I want mercy and not sacrifice. For I came to call not righteous people, but sinners. Then John's disciples came to him and asked, why is it that we and the Pharisees practice fasting, but your disciples do not fast? At this, Jesus said to them, the friends of the bridegroom have no reason to mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them, do they? But days will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, and then they will fast. Nobody sews a patch of unshrunk cloth upon an old outer garment, for its full strength would pull from the outer garment, and the tear would become worse. Neither do people put new wine into old wineskins, but if they do, then the wineskins burst, and the wine spills out, and the wineskins are ruined. But people put new wine into new wineskins, and both things are preserved. While he was telling them these things, look, a certain ruler who had approached, began to do obeisance to him, saying, by now my daughter must be dead, but come, lay your hand upon her, and she will come to life. Then Jesus, getting up, began to follow him, and also his disciples did. Look, a woman suffering 12 years from a flow of blood came up behind and touched the fringe of his outer garment, for she kept saying to herself, if only I touch his outer garment, I shall get well. Jesus turned around, and noticing her, he said, take courage, daughter, your faith has made you well. And from that hour, the woman became well. When now he came into the ruler's house and caught sight of the flute players and the crowd, in noisy confusion, Jesus began to say, leave the place, for the little girl did not die, but she is sleeping. At this, they began to laugh at him scornfully. As soon as the crowd had been sent outside, he went in and took hold of her hand, and the little girl got up. Of course, the talk about this spread out into all that region. As Jesus was passing along from there, two blind men followed him, crying out and saying, have mercy on us, Son of David. After he had gone into the house, the blind men came to him, and Jesus asked them, do you have faith that I can do this? They answered him, yes, Lord. Then he touched their eyes, saying, according to your faith, let it happen to you. And their eyes received sight. Moreover, Jesus sternly charged them, saying, see that nobody gets to know it. But they, after getting outside, made it public about him in all that region. When now they were leaving, look, people brought him a dumb man possessed of a demon. And after the demon had been expelled, the dumb man spoke. Well, the crowds felt amazement and said, never was anything like this seen in Israel. But the Pharisees began to say, it is by the ruler of the demons that he expels the demons. And Jesus set out on a tour of all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the good news of the kingdom and curing every sort of disease and every sort of infirmity. On seeing the crowds, he felt pity for them, because they were skinned and thrown about like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, yes, the harvest is great, but the workers are few. Therefore, beg the master of the harvest to send out workers into his harvest. That's the end of Matthew 9 and Matthew chapter 10. It's a long one, I think, pretty long. So he summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits in order to expel these and to cure every sort of disease and every sort of infirmity. The names of the 12 apostles are these: first, Simon, the one called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, and James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, Philip and Bartholomew, Thomas and Matthew, the tax collector, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, Simon the Cananean, and Judas Iscariot, who later betrayed him. These 12 Jesus sent forth, giving them these orders, do not go off into the road of the nations, and do not enter into a Samaritan city, but instead go continually to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. As you go, preach, saying, the kingdom of the heavens has drawn near. Cure sick people, raise up dead persons, make lepers clean, expel demons. You received free, give free. Do not procure gold or silver or copper for your girdle purses, or a food pouch for the trip, or two undergarments, or sandals, or a staff, for the worker deserves his food. Into whatever city or village you enter, search out who in it is deserving, and stay there until you leave. When you are entering into the house, greet the household, and if the house is deserving, let the peace you wish it come upon it. But if it is not deserving, let the peace from you return upon you. Wherever anyone does not take you in or listen to your words, on going out of that house or that city, shake the dust off your feet. Truly I say to you, it will be more endurable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah on judgment day than for that city. Look, I am sending you forth as sheep amidst wolves. Therefore prove yourselves cautious as serpents, and yet innocent as doves. Be on your guard against men, for they will deliver you up to local courts. Just a minute here. Let's fix this. They will deliver you up to local courts. And they will scourge you in their synagogues. Why, you will be hailed before governors and kings for my sake, for a witness to them and the nations. However, when they deliver you up, do not become anxious about how or what you are to speak. For what you are to speak will be given you in that hour. For the ones speaking are not just you, but it is the Spirit of your Father that speaks by you. Further, brother will deliver up brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and will have them put to death. And you will be objects of hatred by all people on account of my name. But he that has endured to the end is the one that will be saved. The one that will be saved. When they persecute you in one city, flee to another. For truly I say to you, you will by no means complete the circuit of the cities of Israel until the Son of Man arrives. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a slave above his Lord. It is enough for the disciple to become as his teacher and the slave as his Lord. If people have called the householder Beelzebub, if people have called the householder Beelzebub, how much more will they call those of his household so? Therefore, do not fear them, for there is nothing covered over that will not become uncovered, and secret that will not become known. What I tell you in the darkness, say in the light, and what you hear whispered, preach from the housetops. And do not become fearful of those who kill the body, cannot kill the soul, but rather be in fear of him that can destroy both soul and body in Gehenna. Do not two sparrows sell for a coin of small value? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground without your Father's knowledge. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Therefore have no fear, you are worth more than many sparrows. Everyone therefore that confesses union with me before men, I will also confess union with him before my Father who is in the heavens. But whoever disowns me before men, I will also disown him before my Father who is in the heavens. Do not think I came to put peace upon the earth. I came to put not peace, but a sword. For I came to cause division with a man against his father, and a daughter against his mother, and a young wife against her mother-in-law. Indeed, a man's enemies will be persons of his own household. He that has greater affection for father or mother than for me is not worthy of me. And he that has greater affection for son or daughter than for me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not accept his torture stake and follow after me is not worthy of me. He that finds his soul will lose it. And he that loses his soul for my sake will find it. He that receives you receives me also. And he that receives me receives him also that sent me forth. He that receives a prophet because he is a prophet will get a prophet's reward. And he that receives a righteous man because he is a righteous man will get a righteous man's reward. And whoever gives one of these little ones only a cup of cold water to drink because he is a disciple, I tell you truly, he will by no means lose his reward. And that was Matthew chapter 10, Matthew 8 through 10. And we did Psalm chapter 80 and Isaiah chapter 60. So that's it for the study for today. We studied Lauren Lachman's video, or we listened, I should say, to it. Let's get that back if we can. Yeah. Well, that was his video.
Hi. It's Lauren.
Right. And then we also, but perhaps we can, while we're, as we're concluding, or as we're leaving the study today, as we're concluding this video, perhaps we can listen to some more of Andre Genio. From The Very Best of Andre Genio, 2001. This is Ward Green, though, from our study today. Speaking to you on this occasion, reminding you to seek first the kingdom, and that all other things will be added to you. And may God bless you in your endeavors to do so. I would like to tell you how much I love you, that I'm thinking of you, and we will hopefully continue this study on future occasions. And to study the entire Bible will take quite a significant amount of time at the rate at which we're doing it. I estimated perhaps a couple of years if we don't, or perhaps less if we're doing three different books, one chapter from each of three different books every day. Perhaps then we could do it in less than 2 years. I'm not sure, but I didn't do an accurate calculation at all. I just made an estimate based on 66 books and the idea that there are an average of 20 chapters in each book, which may not be correct. It's just an estimate I made, which would then be about 1,400 or 1,300 chapters altogether, divided by 365 days is about 4. And that means if we did 2 chapters every day, it would take us 2 years. So two chapters a day is not enough if we want to get it done in 1 year. But we could increase the rate of our study possibly too. I mean, if we chose to do so. I've just been told, I'm still, by the way, another shipment has just been expedited by Amazon, and I am wearing currently my beautiful sheepskin mules, and they're keeping my feet beautifully warm. I mean, they're quite good. They're quite comfortable to walk in too, as long as I don't have to walk too much, I guess. But I've got the 3/4 insoles in them. The Pro Feet insole, I guess it's called. Is it Pro Feet? Let's look it up and see if there is such a thing. Pro Feet. It's Pro Foot. Pro Foot. Maybe it's Pro Foot. Pro Foot. Yeah. I believe it's Pro Foot, the insole. The Triad. Pro Foot. Yeah. Right. So it was the Profoot insoles that I put in my in my new mules, and they're 3/4 insoles, so they only sit under my heel mainly, and they give me a little bit of arch support that way, a little bit of heel cushion, which my mules lacked. So it's working. It works really. These work well. They're working, but there's not much room in the mules. So what I really need is a very deep, or a good heel cushion that sits, that's a very short insole that's very thin on the front end of it, so it doesn't take up any space from the middle or the toe end of the mule, but only at the heel should it take up space, and that's where the padding should be. If I could find an insole like that, that would be perfect for these mules, even better than these that I'm wearing now. But these are possibly good enough. I'm not sure exactly if they are, but they're certainly functional right now. I was out wearing them when I did the work today, when I did the work from, I worked from above, and then I put my miniature rubber boots, which are my low-cut rubber boots, on my feet to go down and tie the new canvas onto the bottom of the old canvas at the grommets, where I could get access and tie them on. So I think is there another place I need to tie on there or not? I can probably tie the middle on too. Or did I tie that? I don't think I tied the middle on. But the problem is the grommet. The problem is that the bottom of the old canvas is destroyed, and the grommets are coming apart from the main canvas where the canvas is being tattered at the bottom. It's becoming tattered. So the grommets, I'm going to have to fix that in the spring, because the grommet is not well attached to the canvas on the old canvas, and that's what I'm trying to attach the new canvas onto at the bottom, so it doesn't blow too freely in the wind or whatever. It's not that important. It can blow freely, but I prefer if it be neat and tidy, because the new canvas is dragging on the ground too. That's another thing. I need to find a way to fold it up on itself. And I don't know any glue that will dry in that cold temperature. So it's interesting. I've never tried to glue anything in cold weather before, and now I want to do it. There must be some glue that creates a heat reaction that can dry itself or cure itself. I'm sure there is such a thing. I'm sure that's possible. When you mix two glues together, it becomes warm or something, and then cures itself. But maybe if it's cold enough out, that heat will be dissipated too quickly by the outdoor temperature, and it won't cure the glue properly. I've never heard of a glue for outdoor temperatures. I just haven't heard of it. But wasn't the story of Lauren Lachman a fascinating story? How fast he healed. And I'm sure he's experienced healing not just on that one occasion, but on many occasions that was facilitated by fasting. I'm sure he's experienced that phenomenon numerous times. This was just his first experience that highlighted to him how powerful fasting is as a method of increasing the speed of healing in the body. And something that that other people have said, or perhaps Lauren himself, when a dog is sick, it doesn't eat right? Dogs don't eat because they know that fasting is what they need to do when they're sick. So it's just instinctive. But for Lauren to fast for 14 days is quite astounding when he'd just gotten injured and had this important major surgery, you'd say, to his hand to reattach ligaments, nerves, blood vessels, you know, I mean, all of which had been severed. And then for it to heal in 7 weeks because he fasted for 14 days before he started to eat anything. So he was driving himself to get rehabilitation. And I guess he had to start eating because he had to drive himself. He would have lacked strength to drive himself to his rehab. If he had not eaten something after 14 days, I guess he would have been too weak, is what he was saying. 14 days of fasting. Eventually, I mean, if you don't have to go to rehab, you could stay at home for longer than 14 days. You could fast, because if you didn't have to go out, you wouldn't have to be strong enough to drive your car or whatever. So, and that's what I believe he was saying. So, anyway, this is Ward Green. I'll sign off. I was attempting to do so before, but now perhaps I can, because we've come full circle, which is what I think we should do. And the time and date is December 20th, 2022, 16:33 hours. All right. Seek first the kingdom, and all these other things will be added to you. God bless you. I love you. Bye for now.